Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, radio manager at the Recording Library of West Texas. You may have noticed lately our newspaper program has been shortened to an hour, and we have a lack of Odessa American news articles. On Monday, April 17th, Odessa American subscribers were informed the OA was no longer going to provide daily e-editions on their website of the newspaper. The message indicated they would provide the e-edition a few days a week, but did not include details as to what those days will be. A few years ago, the Odessa American reduced the number of days a week it was going to publish actual printed papers. We're trying to use their website to find timely local articles, but those are also limited. We have attempted to contact the Odessa American to find out what days they will publish the e-edition and if there's a way to continue getting daily news articles from the paper, but they have not returned our phone calls and emails. Please bear with us as we continue to try to access and bring you timely news articles from the Odessa American. Some days, this newspaper program may run the full 90 minutes, while other days, we may only have enough content for 60 minutes or less. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. Section A. Pipelines are key to low-carbon economy. ExxonMobil pipeline executive highlights how pipelines must define their importance at Motran Luncheon. By Mella McEwen. A recent movie titled How to Blow Up a Pipeline so alarmed James Beacham, president of the Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance, that he organized a luncheon to highlight the contributions of pipelines. What alarmed him about the movie, which was based on a nonfiction book by a Swedish environmental activist, was not its seeming advocacy for bombing pipelines, he said. Instead, he told the luncheon crowd, what was alarming was that it seemed to justify blowing up pipelines for the greater cause of environmental protection. Let's be honest. There's morons out there who would only blow themselves up, Beacham said. Blowing up a pipeline is no way to solve environmental concerns. He added that Homeland Security officials have been busy briefing area officials about pipeline threats. When you have Homeland Security under the Biden administration briefing people out here, it's serious, he said. Pipelines will play an increasing economic role in the Permian Basin as natural gas production associated with crude production continues to rise in tandem with oil production. The forecast is that natural gas takeaway capacity will rise by 2 billion cubic feet by the third quarter, an additional 6.2 BCF by the fourth quarter, and by an additional 2.5 BCF by the fourth quarter of 2024. We are a tremendous exporter of natural gas, he said. According to statistics cited by Beacham, 32% of all Texas freight tonnage is moved by pipeline. 20% of all freight value moves by pipeline. Pipelines are responsible for 155,600 jobs. Pipelines are responsible for $25 billion in income, $21.8 billion in gross state product, and $6.3 billion in tax revenues. We're not just supporting jobs here in the Permian Basin. We're supporting jobs at Gulf Coast refineries, at Cushing, Oklahoma, or at our ports. We support jobs all across the state, and that's just pipelines, Beecham stated. Just think, he added, how much pollution there would be from all the trucks on the road without pipelines. That's why pipelines are important. The drive toward zero carbon through carbon capture and storage will make pipelines even more important, according to Nick Medina, public and stakeholder engagement manager with ExxonMobil Pipeline. If the industry doesn't tell its own story, he said, it will be defined by others, and not in a positive way. Addressing the luncheon remotely, Medina told the audience pipelines, specifically pipelines transporting carbon dioxide, will be key to a lower carbon economy. You hear a lot about the energy transition, the future of energy, the evolution of energy, low carbon, zero carbon. The Permian Basin will play a key role in delivering the world's energy needs while also finding ways to be more sustainable, he said. The drive toward carbon capture and storage, and even carbon capture utilization and storage, will offer major opportunities for pipelines, he said. Carbon goals will require a wide range of reduction technologies. Carbon capture, utilization, and storage can't be realized without an expanded network of CO2 pipelines. There are currently 5,600 miles of CO2 pipelines globally, 5,300 of that in the U.S., he said. Projections are there will be a tenfold increase in the CO2 pipeline network by 2050. Those new pipelines will cross urban areas and transport CO2 long distances. Successfully expanding that network will require educating the public about the safety of both CO2 and pipelines and their economic benefits, as well as educating first responders on how to correctly handle any emergencies involving CO2 pipelines. According to Medina, by 2025, there will be $50 billion invested in carbon capture and storage, $2 billion of that in pipelines, all creating 10,000 jobs. A decade later, in 2035, he said, that investment will grow to $175 billion, with $9 billion invested in pipelines and 40,000 jobs created. At the beginning of a new era like this, we need to ensure people trust it can be done safely, he said. CO2 is not corrosive. It's not explosive. We take safety very, very seriously. And though we're several years away from starting projects, the time is right to start working with first responders to train them and prepare them. Looking toward future energy sources like hydrogen, Medina pointed out that blue hydrogen is estimated to be 90% of the hydrogen used in the future. Blue hydrogen is derived from natural gas, and the CO2 generated by the manufacturing process is permanently sequestered. Cement, fertilizer, and steel can all utilize hydrogen to become emissions-free, he said. Again, it's derived from natural gas. Fossil fuels are here to stay, and we need to produce fossil fuels to produce the fuels of the future, he said. And pipelines will be needed to transport those fuels of the future, he added.
Kennedy, Student Outcomes MC brand are top priorities by Ben Schaefer. The Midland College presidential candidate forums began Monday with Vice President of Instructional Services Damon Kennedy. Kennedy, the college's lone internal finalist, began by talking about his personal history at Midland College before answering questions. Growing up in Snyder, Kennedy began traveling to Midland College for youth tennis tournaments when he was 7 years old. At age 17, he began attending Midland College as a student. Kennedy left the area to pursue other educational degrees before returning to the college as a faculty member. "I love this place, and this is where I want to be, and this is where I hope to retire," he said Monday. As a Midland College faculty member, Kennedy said onboarding will be seamless for him. He does not have to take time to familiarize himself with the college. Should he take office, Kennedy said his first 30 days as president would be dedicated to listening to faculty members, students, administrators, and the rest of the college community to zero in on ways to continue to move Midland College forward. Kennedy said that his goals are centered on student success, continuing to invest in Midland College faculty and staff to give them the tools to be successful, and fostering positive relationships within the college community and the Midland community at large. "If we're not moving the needle on student outcomes, then there's some misalignment somewhere, and we have to figure that out," Kennedy remarked. Kennedy also said the college needs to increase its focus marketing. Within his first 90 days as president, he said the college will have developed a broad marketing strategy. "Midland College doesn't tell its story, and we have a pretty remarkable story to tell. We just don't do it," Kennedy added. He said there are incentives and programs being implemented at the college that will continue to hold and build on should he assume the role. Those include the planning and designing of the new Career and Technical Education Center, a joint project with Midland Independent School District. As a former faculty senate president, Kennedy said that he values feedback from faculty members. He used this feedback to shift some of the college classes and programs to 8-week terms rather than 16-week semesters. "I think the implementation of the 8-week term is the best example of the back and forth that I think is so crucial in the evolution of an institution," he said. Kennedy labeled his management style as inclusive and collaborative. He said he wants to put faculty and staff in a position where they can be successful and make valuable decisions for themselves. "I'm not a micromanager. I want to empower people to lead. I want to empower people to take risk. I think that the only way to advance in an institution," he remarked. In terms of enrollment, Kennedy said the number of students at the college will continue to go backwards without strong marketing efforts from the college. He said the college has retreated from the community and must get re-engaged. He discussed past Midland College initiatives that incorporated young people in the community that have since been ceased. "We're not letting kids know that they're a great option here," he said. In addition, he said he wants to reinvigorate student activities and clubs. Kennedy said his nomination has been humbling, and the feedback from the community during his presidential candidate process is crucial. $195 for Bush Ace Athletic Center by Mella McEwen. Bush Tennis Center's efforts to develop the Bush Ace Athletic Center have garnered support from the Midland Development Corporation. Members of the MDC board unanimously approved a resolution executing a promotional agreement between the MDC and Bush Tennis Center. The agreement calls for MDC to disburse $995,000 contingent upon BTC securing commitment totaling $11.2 million for the project no later than December 31, 2024, and provides documentation for those commitments. The Bush Ace Athletic Center is planned for the east side of the Bush Tennis Center at 5700 Briarwood Avenue and will be an athletic and training facility with 5 indoor basketball courts, a 50-year indoor turf field, and an 8,000-square-foot high-performance training facility. "The facility will let us expand our platform to other sports," Tim Stallard, BTC executive director, told the board members. He predicted it would provide $45 million a year in economic impact. The agreement calls for BTC to reimburse the funds of construction if the new center is not complete by December 31, 2025. MDC Chairman Chase Gerdafi called the project a great step forward to establish a regional sports center and get us into travel sports. Board members also addressed 2 road projects on the agenda. A resolution authorized in the execution of a professional services agreement with Kimley Horn and Associates for $1,443 for services related to the widening and improving State Highway 158 from Sinclair Avenue to Wadley Avenue and then from Wadley Avenue North to Briarwood Avenue. The widening would turn State Highway 158 into an urban arterial road, Gardafi said. MDC Executive Director Sarah Harris and MDC is providing funds for the design and engineering services may accelerate TxDOT's funds for construction, as had happened with other project in Midland, with upfront dollars being provided by MDC. Board members also approved an economic development agreement with the City of Midland to provide $86,000 in incentive funds for engineering and design work for median additions at the intersection of State Highway 191 and State Highway 158. The contract with Midwest Wrecking Company for the demolition of the Western United Life building was amended to include demolition and cleanup of city-owned property at 405 Lorraine, estimated at $67,280. Under the agreement, the city will reimburse MDC for the cost of the project. MISD Education Foundation honors district's shining stars. Midland Reporter Telegram. Students, families, and staff gathered last week for Midland Education Foundation Shining Stars Breakfast at the Midland College Carrasco Room. The top 10 students at Midland High and Legacy High, as well as the top students at Early College High School at Midland College and Coleman High School, were recognized and rewarded scholarships. Here's a list of the year's top students. Midland High's top 10: Summer Pennell, Lillian Smith, Kaden Carriger, Grace Ware, Siddeley Mills, Shaney Jamie, Sarah Stewart, Grayson Petty, Emily Corbett, Stella McDonald. Legacy High top 10: Janik Bakta, Kendall Harrington, Zyra Briggs, Mylon Green, Claire Hall, Elizabeth Babel, Cassie Bond, Carissa Perez, Bryson Baylor, Ying Moi. Early College High School top students: Andre Barber Malero, Arek Kahader. Coleman High School top student: Danielle Quihus Velarde. This is Christy, and I'm continuing to read Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, May 2, 2023. A&M Center: medium home prices set new county record, by Stuart Doreen. Never has the median price of a home in Midland County sold for as much as it did during the month of March, according to the Texas A&M Real Estate Center. The center reported that the median price of a home sold in March jumped $42,505 compared to February. The $342,005 set a new standard, topping the $340,000 set in August. It also was the 22nd straight month that the median price for a home sold in Midland County reached $300,000 in a month. February's original total, $298,000, was changed to $300,000. The average total of a home also jumped from $329,000 in February to $382,310 in March. That average was third highest since the Texas A&M Real Estate Center started keeping track in 2011. March also was the 55th straight month that the average price for a home sold in Midland County topped $300,000, a streak that goes back to September 2018. One reason for the increase might be the deadline in inventory. The 461 homes on the market at the end of the month was the fewest since June 2019, 455. The 1.9 months of inventory was the smallest since March 2022. A comparison of Midland and other West Texas counties and large metropolitan counties across the state show the median price of a home sold increased more and pushed Midland County head and shoulders above the regional cities. The median price in Midland County in March was $342,005, was nearly $100,000 greater than the median price in Odessa, $244,000, and significantly higher than Randall County, $259,950, Tom Green County, $258,000, Taylor County, $242,700, and Lubbock County, $240,000. In fact, the total dollar volume in Midland County, $112,016,000, was within $8 million of the volume of the more populated Lubbock County, $119,961,000. Midland's median price for a home sold in March is also greater than the prices reported from Tarrant County, $340,000, Montgomery County, $325,000, Harris County, $300,000, and Behar County, $297,000. March housing report, Midland County, sales $293,000, total dollar volume $112,016,000, average price for a home sold $382,310, median price for a home sold $342,005, homes available 461, months of inventory 1.9, source Texas A&M Real Estate Center.
This is Thoris with the Odessa American News for Wednesday, May the 3rd. The headline is, Judge Takes Issue with City Attorney's Remarks. Back in January, the City Council met in chambers to discuss advertising Odessa Municipal Court Presiding Judge Carlos Rodriguez's job, but tabled taking action. On April the 26th, newly appointed City Attorney Dan Jones told the council Rodriguez ignored a Texas Supreme Court official's directives regarding a court security committee. According to internal emails obtained Monday by the Odessa American under the Texas Public Information Act, the judge is disputing Jones's portrayal of the events. During the 85th legislative session, the Texas legislature passed the Judge Julie Kocurek Judicial and Courthouse Security Act of 2017. As a result, municipal judges were ordered to establish court security committees. In addition, a court security division was created at the Texas Supreme Court's Office of Court Administration to help courts conduct and review security and emergency preparedness. On April the 25th, Jones reported Rodriguez told interim city manager Agabito Bernal that the OCA's security director, Hector Gomez, told him he could not provide him or the city council any of the security committee's agendas or meeting minutes. Jones further said he was concerned Rodriguez had not appointed Bernal or city council members to the security committee, even though it's the council's responsibility to fund security measures at the courthouse. He said he reached out to Gomez and Gomez had a frank discussion with him. The point of it is that Judge Rodriguez has not included any of you sitting there on this, which he needs to, he was told by Mr. Gomez, a former U.S. Marshal. He handles all of this for the state of Texas, Jones said. The council responded by unanimously appointing Bernal and City Council member Greg Connell to the committee, which includes Court Director Kimberly Joswack, Assistant City Prosecutor James Kevin McKeithen, Judge Keith Kidd, and Odessa Police Corporal Jason Ball. In an email sent by Gomez to Jones on April the 20th, he said he advised Rodriguez he could provide the agenda and minutes to the City Council and management. He also said it is his recommendation City Management and a member of the City Council be a part of the security committee. However, he did not indicate if he mentioned that to Rodriguez. The day after the city council meeting, Rodriguez sought to clarify matters in an email to Bernal, security committee members, and council members Denise Swanner and Mark Matta. In it, the judge said things had been blown up out of proportion. Rodriguez wrote he confirmed with Gomez that the meeting minutes and agendas are judicial records that, under Section 12 of the Rules of Judicial Administration, are exempt from disclosure. However, he said he was waiting for Gomez to check with his general counsel to see if they could be released to Bernal and council members, and if so, how to do it without them being vulnerable to release to the general public. As of April the 26th, Rodriguez said he hadn't heard from Gomez, and he suspected it was because Gomez had spoken with Jones and may have felt the issue had been resolved. Mr. Gomez and I did not have any conversation about who should serve on the committee, other than a recommendation that I involve law enforcement, as our conversation was focused on the release of judicial records, Rodriguez wrote. Mr. Gomez did not give me the recommendation that he gave Mr. Jones, that a member of council and city management should serve on the committee. If Gomez had given him the recommendation, Rodriguez said he would have followed it, as he is the expert in this topic. The judge even pointed out that Gomez didn't say in his email to Jones that he'd made the recommendation to him. The judge said Jones made the same recommendation during an earlier meeting, but he had wanted to look into the law and any potential conflict before committing to do so. But again, I would have followed Mr. Gomez's recommendation. Rodriguez said it was portrayed as though he was intentionally dismissing Gomez's recommendations, but he was not. I have not been attempting to exclude you or counsel, just wanting to be sure I am in compliance with the law and statute before making any decisions, Rodriguez said. With that said, I am glad Mr. Gomez gave a solution that will work for everyone. I look forward to welcoming you and Counsel Connell to the committee and will email you when we set up our next meeting. Gomez did not immediately respond to emails seeking clarification on the matter. In earlier troubles, during the January 24th meeting, a handful of Odessa attorneys stood before the city council and strenuously objected to replacing Rodriguez on the bench. Attorney Gavin Norris speculated Rodriguez was on the chopping block because he may have gotten into a dispute with Mayor Javier Hoven after Hoven sent a letter to him and Kidd about Operation Graduation. In the letter, Hoven wrote, "I request that you consider the maximum penalty for any social host violations and for any minor in possession citations." Norris described the letter as being inappropriate, but Hoven insisted he wasn't trying to intimidate the judges. Norris and attorney Anthony Robles also wondered if someone was upset that steps had been taken to restrict access to juvenile records. Jobles went so far as to poll each of the council members as to whether they were accessing juvenile records. All denied doing so, including Swanner, who at the time was working for Teen Court as an assistant coordinator. Following the meeting, Teen Court coordinator Rebecca Grisham said Swanner had occasionally accessed the files up until 3 years prior when a new policy was implemented prohibiting Swanner, herself, and other city employees from accessing them. Rodriguez and Jozawak both joined the court 3 years ago. Swanner was fired from her position in March. In an email to her board, Grisham said she still fully supported Swanner, but there were some issues and conflicts regarding Teen Court and her position on city council that we never could have foreseen when she decided to run a few years ago. Local news roundup. 2 arrested on drug charges. Officers who thought they were going to a murder in progress call ended up making a drug arrest instead. According to an Odessa Police Department report, someone from the Hawthorne Suites on South John Ben Shepherd Parkway Boulevard called 911 around 4 a.m. Saturday to report a man was trying to drown a woman who had overdosed. When officers arrived, they were directed to a room by a hotel manager who said the woman inside was overdosing and turning purple, the report stated. The officers found Jennifer Gutierrez, 21, conscious and breathing and on a nearby TV stand, a clear plastic bag of Xanax tablets, the report stated. After executing a search warrant, the officers found a total of 7.8 grams of cocaine, 4.5 grams of Percocet, 5.5 grams of Xanax, and 7.3 grams of buspirone, an anxiety medication. A woman told officers an unknown man brought cocaine and fentanyl-laced Percocet pills to the motel room, and when Gutierrez began to overdose, she grabbed the phone to call 911, the report stated. She told officers Devon James Everhart, 23, took the phone away from her. Gutierrez, an Odessa resident, was arrested on suspicion of 2 counts of possession of a controlled substance, one a third-degree felony and the other a misdemeanor. Everhart, a Kyle resident, was arrested on suspicion of 3 counts of possession of a controlled substance, possession of a dangerous drug, and interference with an emergency request for assistance. He was also arrested on failure to appear warrants issued by Hays County. Three of Everhart's drug counts are second-degree felonies punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Everhart remained in the Ector County Jail Monday on surety bonds totaling $128,000. Gutierrez also remained in custody Monday on surety bonds totaling $17,500. Trio arrested on solicitation charges. Three men were arrested recently following an undercover operation designed to track down human traffickers. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety and arrest affidavits, the men separately responded to undercover agents' internet ads and arranged to meet via text messages with someone they knew to be 15 or 16 in order to have sex, and then showed up at the predetermined site. Arrested on suspicion of online solicitation of a minor, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison were Joel Elizondo, 33, of Kingsville, and Luis Rosales, 53, of Monahans, and Nathan Dubois, 27, of Big Spring. DPS worked with the Texas Highway Patrol, Odessa Police Department, and the Midland County Sheriff's Office on the operation, which ran from April the 26th to April the 29th. Woman accused of stabbing sister. A 24-year-old woman was arrested Friday after family members told authorities she stabbed her 29-year-old sister in the face. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, deputies received a disturbance call around 2:30 p.m. Friday from the 10,000 block of West Chaparral. When deputies arrived, a 47-year-old woman said she and one of her daughters had gone to the home on West Chaparral to check on her younger daughter, Isabel Alexandre Nuez, because she was intoxicated to the point of losing consciousness. According to the report, the woman said when Nuez woke up, she got a knife from the kitchen and stabbed her other daughter in the cheek. A man in the home said the two sisters were in a physical fight when Nuez, his girlfriend, stabbed her sister, according to the report. Medicare provides hospice at no cost. Hospice, a subject no one wants to discuss with an elderly loved one. When a loved one is terminally ill, it takes an emotional toll on the caregiver, the family, as well as the patient. Many Americans wait too long to discuss hospice benefits with the patient's doctor because they believe hospice is for the last days to help a person die peacefully. They are not aware that hospice can give hope along this journey through education, medication to manage symptoms, support to the patient and family, and counseling services for the patient, family members, and caregivers. Healthcare professionals in the hospice system include physicians, nurses, social workers, spiritual counselors, certified nursing assistants, and volunteers. A hospice provider comes to where the patient lives to provide the care. The Medicare and You Handbook explains what hospice is in Medicare terms and what Medicare covers for hospice under Part A of Medicare. A doctor who orders hospice must certify that a patient is terminally ill and has 6 months or less to live. When a patient agrees to hospice care, they agree to comfort care instead of treatment to cure the illness and must sign a statement choosing hospice care instead of other Medicare-covered treatments for the terminal illness. Hospice can be recertified every 6 months by a hospice medical director or hospice doctor if the patient is still terminally ill. Original Medicare will be billed for the hospice care. Hospice will cover all medical care for terminal illness, and Original Medicare or Medicare Advantage Plan will pay for health problems that are unrelated. Copays will apply. Medicare certified hospice care is usually given in the home or other facility, like a nursing or personal care home. Additional details on hospice are explained in Chapter 2 of the Medicare Survival Guide, Advanced Edition. Medicare costs under hospice. You pay nothing for hospice care. Medicare pays. You pay a co-payment of up to $5 per prescription for outpatient prescription drugs for pain and symptom management. You pay nothing for Medicare-approved inpatient respite care, which is a five-day stay in a Medicare-approved facility so that the caregiver can have a period of rest. You can go on this journey helplessly or choose to have control over yours or a loved one's end-of-life plan of care. Know that hospice provides comfort, dignity, love, and support. Talk with a geriatric case manager or geriatric doctor if you have concerns or need advice with your loved one's terminal health care issue. Patients suffering from dementia is also covered under hospice care. For assistance with enrollment and personalizing your Medicare, contact the Tony Says office at 832-519-8664 or email your Medicare questions to info@tonisays.com. Landgraf Craddock legislation passes the House. Legislation filed by State Representative Brooks Landgraf to establish the Texas Severance Tax Revenue and Oil and Natural Gas Defense Fund, also known as STRONG, to address critical needs in major energy-producing areas of Texas, including the Permian Basin, passed out of the Texas House of Representatives on Monday with nearly unanimous approval. Texas Strong is about doing what is necessary so that Texas can be a global force for good, Landgraf said. It's about defending the Texas energy industry, upstream, downstream, and everything and everyone in between, because of how important it all is to our state budget and economy, as well as geopolitics and American freedom. My Texas Strong plan will keep more of the state taxes generated in the oil patch, invested in the schools, colleges, healthcare institutions, and first responders that serve our underserved energy-producing communities. The Texas Strong Defense Fund would receive a portion of severance tax revenue for the purpose of supporting transportation infrastructure, workforce and economic development, public education, healthcare, and public safety needs in regions of the state with the highest oil and gas production. If successful, the measures would result in hundreds of millions of dollars being available for energy-producing communities as early as next year. Landgraf's legislation also dictates portions of the severance taxes collected by the state to be used for property tax relief across Texas and accounts used to clean up Texas air and groundwater contamination. I filed joint House Resolution 111 and House Bill 2207 because I believe that's what's best for the Permian Basin is what's best for the Lone Star State, Landgraf continued. It's impossible to articulate how proud I am to serve our region in the Texas House. That is why I'm going to continue fighting tooth and nail to pass Texas Strong. This legislation is the answer to the needs of the oil and gas producing areas of the state. These communities are the economic generators for Texas and the United States. We owe these communities an investment into their roads, infrastructure, healthcare, schools, and so much more, said Craddock. Saturday event will have tributes to those lost. When Michelle Watson lost her son to fentanyl in August of 2020, she vowed to save other mothers from experiencing her agony. It took her a while to battle through her depression, but Watson is now going full throttle. Watson created the 111 Project in November, gave a school presentation in Big Lake in January, created a website, and stood before the Odessa City Council last month. On Saturday, the project is co-hosting a rally at the Ector County Courthouse from 4 to 7 p.m. Tributes will be made to those who have lost their lives to fentanyl, and educational materials will be handed out by co-host Association of People Against Lethal Drugs and other organizations like Reach Recovery. On August 5, 2020, Watson said her son, Malachi Mitchell, was a 20-year-old man who was raising his one-year-old son, Julian, with his girlfriend, Noelle, in Midland, working security and striving to obtain his GED. He'd spent the day with Julian and Noelle, and that night decided to go out with some friends. At 1:30 a.m., Watson said she got a call from Noel. "She's just screaming, saying, 'You have to get over here. Malachi is blue and his feet are cold, and I just remember jumping out of bed. I mean, I don't even remember putting clothes on. I just flew across town,' Watson said. 'When I ran up the 3 flights of stairs into her apartment and I just saw him lying on the floor, I knew that he was gone. I mean, I knew it. He's my son. I'm yelling at him. I'm asking him, please wake up. But I could tell that he was gone, and I could feel it in my soul.'" She would later learn Malachi had asked someone for Percocet, a pain reliever made of oxycodone and acetaminophen. Unbeknownst to him, it also contained a lethal amount of fentanyl. "We as mothers do not call it an overdose at all, because they didn't know what they were getting. None of these kids knew that they were ingesting fentanyl, synthetic fentanyl that is coming from China and Mexico. They all thought that they were taking whatever they asked for. You know, my Malachi, for instance, wanted to take a Percocet,' Watson said. She knows another mother who lost a daughter when she unknowingly took ibuprofen that had been laced with fentanyl. She'd had a headache at a party and asked for a Tylenol or its equivalent," Watson said. "It is now her mission to educate parents and kids alike that tragedies like hers are happening every 11 seconds in the United States, hence the name of her organization. These kids want to live this YouTube lifestyle, and they think it's all fun and games, and, oh, let's go there. The Lil Wayne song talking about popping Molly, and of course that's what they all want to do because they hear it on the radio and on TV and everything else. So was Malachi a perfect kid? No, but is any kid perfect? No," Watson said. Since Malachi died, Watson, an insurance agent, said she has met entirely too many parents who have also lost their children to fentanyl. Several have joined her in her efforts to educate the public about fentanyl, which can kill in doses as small as 2 mg/s. She was thrilled when Odessa City Council members invited her to join them when they announced April 25th that the city will receive $600,000 to fight the opioid crisis. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has joined finalized opium agreements with CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, and the opiate manufacturer Allergan, thus securing the state hundreds of thousands of dollars. During the April 25th meeting, Mayor Javier Hoven said Councilmember Denise Swanner suggested the city apply for a portion of the settlements. The city received its first check of more than $175,000. Recently, and Police Chief Mike Gerke is working with Swanner and Councilmember Mark Mata to determine how the funds should be spent. "I would hope that they would donate to local organizations that are actually out there with boots on the ground trying to fight this, because we could definitely use it," Watson said. "I mean, me going into schools and presentations, print materials are costly. Travel, things like that, it costs so much. Any little bit helps." Young Entrepreneur Day to showcase student ideas. Adavita Private School has set its third annual Young Entrepreneur Day for 5:30 to 8 p.m. today at MKA Special Occasions, 500 South Grant Avenue. The event showcases products created by pre-kindergarten through 8th grade students. Vasti Urias is in her third year of taking part in the event. Her idea is a selfie booth like the one she and her parents saw when they visited Miami last summer. "We were walking by the streets and there was a sign that said Selfie Museum. And my mom was like, 'Oh, I've heard about these. Why don't we go in?' So we went inside, and basically they all have these booths. They have different backgrounds where you can take pictures and stuff. It was a very cool experience," said Urias, a 13-year-old 8th grader. Urias realized Odessa didn't have a selfie museum, so she created one. "We took 4 foam insulated walls, we put them together with door hinges, and then we painted them and put backgrounds on them so every person can take them in all 4 booths for $10, and they can take it with their own phones. Models can create their portfolios. People could take their profile pictures for Instagram, or if they're an influencer, just to take pictures and post them so it could all be in one section. You can also take it to parties, to social events, to schools, because it is portable, since it has the door hinges. You close them, you can put them in your truck, and then you can drive off and put them where you would like, Urias said. Many people like to take photos to capture the moment and save that moment forever. I want them to have it with a fun background. For example, I have four backgrounds. One of them has an Instagram frame as a prop so they can hold it up and they can smile. Then I have another, which is a black background with neon frames on them, which I'm planning to put in a corner so that the frames don't really come out as bright. I have a money wall, which are just lines of $100 bills. And then we have little props around, like they have sunglasses and stuff like that. And then we have an ice cream room, which has an ice cream neon light with a pink background and sprinkles on it that says, "I scream for selfie," Urias said. She added that she loves Young Entrepreneur Day. They're really fun. I think it's a way that we can express ourselves and really get the feel of what it's like of selling products and what it's like talking to judges and what it's like being an entrepreneur and getting out in the world and selling things. So I definitely think it's a very fun idea, Urias said. Brothers Maverick and Jackson Kilgore created a shop where you can get keychains, magnets, and coasters. Maverick, 7, is in kindergarten, and Jason, 5, is in pre-kindergarten. Maverick said he and his brother had fun working on the project. His dad taught him how to make the items, and then he did it himself. He added that he's excited about Young Entrepreneur Day. London Cuves, a 9-year-old third grader, and Zoe Soto, an 8-year-old third grader, explained their projects. Cuves made bath bombs, and Soto, snow cones. The bath bombs come in watermelon, grape, coconut, and pineapple. Deciding on bath bombs was easy for Cuves, as she loves the way they smell and make the water fizz and change color. She would make the bombs and then let them sit for a week. Cuves said she learned to make them from a video. Soto said she was going to offer slushies at first, but that didn't work out, so they settled on snow cones instead. They will come in 12 different flavors, and she will sell popcorn and pickles. Cuves said she likes Young Entrepreneur Day because you make a lot of money. School founder Linda Subio said the students have to fill out paperwork with the design thinking process questions. Subia said the students will have to write down how much money they spent and how much profit they're going to make. They have to turn all that in, and then they have to make their presentation board, and then they have to be able to speak to the community about it and describe how they made it, how they created it, and what were the flaws. Like Zoe mentioned, they wanted to do slushies, but it didn't turn out good, so she had to change it to snow cones. She was problem-solving, Subia said. There were also flaws with the bath bomb, Subia said. There are about 35 students involved in Young Entrepreneur Day, and siblings have combined their projects. I think every year it gets better and better, Subia said of the projects and the event. It's nice to see the kids get excited about it. The upper grades have been working on theirs for a couple of months, and they really want to get out there and make money. They really have good ideas. I'm really surprised with what kids come up with, Subia said. Amanda Tijerina, co-founder of Adavinda, said a lot of the students created websites and commercials made with artificial intelligence to go with their projects. Subia said the parents get very involved with the projects. One of the school's objectives is to get parents working side by side with their children, having fun and creating something they can sell together. Our vision for the school was to teach our kids how to be leaders and how to get out and meet people, socialize with the community, and to give them the skills that they need because, of course, the skills are in the state, TEKS, for financial literacy. But we wanted to give them that hands-on collaboration with community and the knowledge of research, design thinking, and just creating products and being innovative. We talked to them before they started their projects. We talked about Steve Jobs, how he invented the first iPhone. Everybody wanted it. They didn't know what he was going to present under the red cloth, but people still went, and they wanted to know what he was presenting to them. Everybody wanted the iPhone. The iPhone is still the best, Subia said. Obituaries. Willie Howard Harris age 76, of Voss, Texas, passed away on Friday, April the 28th, at his residence. Mary Elizabeth Baxter, age 76, of Odessa, beloved wife and mother, returned home to the Lord on Friday, April the 28th, after a lengthy battle with cancer. Sandra Deanna Day Phillips, of Austin, Texas, has passed away. Greg Davis Brazil, age 68, of Midland, died Friday, April the 28th, in San Angelo. Jose Juan Bustillos, age 75, of Odessa, died Wednesday, April the 26th, in Odessa. Jose Manuel Concepcion Roman, age 38, of Midland, died Saturday, April the 29th, in Midland. Stella May Aulet, age 92, of Odessa, died Sunday, April the 30th, in Odessa.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the education section of Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, May the 2nd, 2023. Midland Classical Academy's Mastery with Honor Recognition Night by Stuart Doreen. Mastery with Honor Recognition Night, which took place on April 27th at Midland Classical Academy. Judges Award winners Charlotte Wolfmuller, 8th grade biology, frog dissection in yarn. Hudson Beard, 10th grade pre-calculus, software for frequency transformation. Julia Langto, 10th grade world history 2, revisiting the classics on piano. Jenna Perea, 10th grade great books 3, Frankenstein and his monster. Connor Benton, 11th grade fine arts 1, paintings of the American underdog. Afton Bundy, 11th grade, chemistry, scholarship for West Texas Neuro Solutions. Judges finalists, Cooper Beard, 8th grade, biology, raising a beehive. Cooper Beard, 8th grade, great books 1, Joshua, son of Nun, novel. Parker L., 9th grade, world history 1 and great books 2, Perpetua, a story of a Christian martyr novella. Parker L., 9th grade, Greek 1 and New Testament, biblical scenes in Greek and English. Connor Aylman, 10th grade, physics 3D printed trebuchet. Lydia Perea, 10th grade, great books 3, embroidery of Shakespeare's Ophelia from Hamlet. Connor Benton, 11th grade, geometry, tessellations in coloring sheets. Afton Bundy, 11th grade, American history, hand-sewn Betsy Ross flag. J.C. Williams, 11th grade, chemistry, artificial versus natural flavors. Dean's honorable mentions. Hudson Beard, 10th grade, great books 3, computer imagery of Dante's Mount Purgatory. Carolyn Christopher, 10th grade, great books 3, dress of Dante's Purgatory. Joe Dunn, 10th grade, great books 3, Dante's Pit of Hell in Legos. Michael Fisher, 10th grade, World War II, World History II, An Important Man, Stained Glass, and Jonah Stevens, 10th grade, American History, MacGyver's Homemade Radio. Teacher Seeks Phonics-Based Decodable Books by Ben Schaefer. Ms. Lewis, a teacher at General Tommy Franks Elementary School, is seeking phonics-based decodable books for students with dyslexia. The project expires on August 20th. There is $1,172 needed to fully fund it. Decodable books focus on phonics skills that can be used to help my students feel like they are reading, Lewis posted. Lewis added in her post that having decodable books will motivate her students to read and allow her to build her own classroom library. Online at donorschoose.org/project/books7300184.
Does weight control or better diabetes improve lichen planus? By Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, I read your recent article on lichen planus. I have suffered with this for 2.5 years. After doing a lot of research, I found that many people, like me, have diabetes. Nothing helped it, and the last treatment was too dangerous for me, although it did help me to lose 35 pounds, and my sugar levels are now healthy. I understand that I can never get rid of lichen planus and that it's just in remission now. Signed, N.T. Answer. Most studies show that people with diabetes are somewhat more likely to develop lichen planus, an itchy skin condition. About 1.5% of people with diabetes will develop lichen planus, while 0.75% of people without diabetes will. Unfortunately, I could not confirm that either weight loss or better diabetes control improve the symptoms of lichen planus. Sometimes lichen planus becomes inactive on its own. However, there are many good reasons to keep diabetes under control, and I am publishing your letter with the hope that it helps someone else. This is Mackie, and I'll be reading from the Odessa American paper, Saturday, April 29th, 2023. Dear Abby, abuse survivor has turned to food to deal with past. Dear Abby, in many ways, I am blessed. I have an amazing family, a great husband, and a well-paying job that I enjoy. My only problem is I hate myself. I hide my pain with humor. I'm pretty funny. I have some childhood sexual abuse trauma and have had a lot of counseling. I'm hesitant to blame my current issues on something that happened so long ago, but why can't I get my life together? I'm so happy now, so why is this dragging me down? I combat my inner pain, stress, and hate by eating. I cannot stop. I have gained so much weight, it is hard to do normal activities. I am tired, disgusted, and ashamed of being so out of control. None of my clothes fit. Every social situation is unbelievably overwhelming. I have tried diet after diet. Some work, but nothing sticks long term. I have removed all the mirrors in my house so I won't have to look at myself. My family and friends are amazing, loving, and supportive. My world would be nothing without them. How can I mentally wire my jaw shut so I don't shove every piece of food I see down my gullet? Signed, Exploding in Washington. Dear Exploding, you are far from the only person who has used food to mask emotional pain. There is truth in the saying, it's not what you're eating, but what's eating you that may be the problem. Two trusted organizations may be able to help you conquer this. The first is the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. RAINN has been mentioned in my column many times. When you contact this group, it could connect you with counseling tailored to survivors of sexual abuse and help you to deal with any lingering issues from your childhood trauma. The second organization is Overeaters Anonymous. OA is a support group for people who can't control their eating based on the principles of AA. When you make contact, you will find them to be sympathetic and supportive. There is no judging, weighing, or shaming. It may give you the moral and emotional support you need to regain control. I'm rooting for you. Dear Abby, a lonely friend who lives several hours away wants to visit me for a few days. He keeps bringing up the subject of visiting while I try to steer the conversation in another direction. My wife isn't keen on the idea of someone she's not familiar with staying with us. I don't consider us close friends, and I have never invited him to stay. I prefer he not visit, mainly due to my wife's concerns. Is there a way to get him to stop asking without losing his friendship? I suppose I could live without the friendship, but I don't want to hurt him. Signed, Flummoxed in Florida. Dear Flummoxed, tell this pushy individual you and your wife cannot accommodate a house guest. Whatever the reason may be, it's the truth. Keep repeating it as often as necessary.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.